In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the Federal Reserve, trying to get a better idea of what it is, what it does, and perhaps also how, because things have changed in this country and it has been given a different sort of a mission, how it's likely to change in the future. And then our guest with the program is Martin Mayer. He's a financial journalist who has more than 30 books to his credit, including The Bankers and The Greatest Ever Bank Robbery. He currently is a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's a contributor to The Wall Street Journal and to Barron's, and a popular columnist for OnMoney.com. His home is in Washington, D.C. He's talking with us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, we certainly welcome whatever questions, comments you may have. The only thing we ask is that people try to be brief, and we just ask that to keep things moving along and to make it possible for us to get as many different callers in as possible. But anybody's welcome to call. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Mayer, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Not at all.
We appreciate it.
It's not important that I'm talking right now. What's important is that Greenspan is talking right now.
Well, you know, that's
annual Humphrey Hawkins testimony to the Congress. Yep.
That was where I was going to start, because he is frequently in the news. The Fed is mentioned in the news, as you say. He was on Capitol Hill just today talking about the economy.
I'm pretty sure he's still there, though I haven't tried to listen. I mean, I read his testimony and tuned in very briefly. Now he's carrying what is perhaps the greatest burden the chairman of the Federal Reserve System has to carry, which is answering questions from ill-informed people in Congress.
Well,
that's not a joke, by the way.
I have to confess to being an ill-informed interviewer, so you can answer my ill-informed questions. I guess the place that I wanted to start was, you know, as you say,
he can't say to somebody, "That's a dumb question." He simply can't say it. And his ability to convert a dumb question into something to which you can give an intelligent answer is perhaps his greatest single talent as chairman of the Fed.
Hmm. I think for as much as he is in the news, and I would have to include myself in this, I really think that most folks have little or no understanding of what the Fed does.
Yep.
And that's where I thought we could perhaps start, is to have you talk a little bit about exactly what is the function of the Federal Reserve?
Well, it is a very large institution. It has more than 20,000 employees, and it's the most profitable institution in the United States, makes more than $20 billion a year, turns it over to the Treasury. money that the Fed makes is called seigniorage. It's got a long history. That if you can print money, it costs you very little to print a bill, and by God, you go out, and because it's legal tender, people have to take it. That's a very profitable activity, and that is the Fed's fundamental activity, is the creation of money, and it was put up for that purpose. We had a very inflexible monetary system in this country prior to World War II, and we had a nasty financial crisis in 1907. And people decided we better do something about that. It was universally agreed that the United States did not want and should not have a central bank. We had had one in the Bank of the United States in the first 20 years of the Republic, and then again from 1816 to 1836. Actually, the bank lasted a little longer than that, but Andrew Jackson, in effect, killed it sooner. There was a strong feeling here. It's a continent. We don't need the same monetary conditions in different parts of the country, which, by the way, was true and is true, but there's nothing you can do under conditions of modern communications. Anyway, the Federal Reserve System was set up with several purposes, one of them to provide a flexible money supply. When the country needed more money, it shouldn't run up against an artificially induced ceiling, which was what we'd had before. Most of the paper currency in circulation was notes issued by national banks. National banks were permitted to issue notes only to the extent of their holding of U.S. Treasury paper, government bonds, and in the early years of the 20th century, those holdings were shrinking, so that the currency supply was shrinking at precisely the time we were pulling out of the recession of the 1890s. Anyway, that's where it comes from. Its basic purpose is to create bank reserves which permit banks to make loans. And it goes back to a time when 70%, 80% of all financial intermediation in this country was in the form of bank lending. And the big this was true up through the 1950s and even into the 1960s. The big change to which the institution has had great difficulty responding is that today banks do only about 20% of the financial intermediation. And you know, your mortgage is not held by a bank. It is probably mediated through the Federal National Mortgage Association or the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation and in some insurance company's portfolio. Your credit card debt is not something that the bank is carrying for, is that the bank holds. The bank has, quote, securitized it and sold it in the market as an asset-backed security. So far as big corporations are concerned, they borrow in the commercial paper market through brokers. They don't use banks much, so they do once in a while. this enormous boom that we've had in the high-tech area has been financed to a very modest degree by banks, mostly through the sale of, through venture capitalists and then initial public offerings of stock. So that the Fed, which is an institution formed to help out with banking system and money supply, now finds itself confronting a world where the banks are not all that important, and the Fed has to operate through the markets.
Mm-hmm.
If I can go one more minute with this,
sure,
with this question. One of my favorite stories is from the memoirs of Sherman Mazel, who was the governor of the Federal Reserve in the 60s and 70s. And William McChesney Martin had been chairman of the Fed from 1951 to 1969, and he was to be replaced by Richard Nixon's old buddy Arthur Burns. Nixon had a ceremony at the White House in the Oval Office and invited the governors of the Fed to attend, which they did. And Nixon, being in one of his more jovial and playful moods, said that the government really needed some more money, and he was hoping that Arthur Burns, as an old friend, would make life easier, would make interest rates lower so the government could borrow cheaper, and would, in general, stimulate the economy. And Mazel said that the members of the board were extremely embarrassed by this because, in fact, they had voted a week before to lower interest rates and ease monetary conditions, and nobody knew it, not even the President of the United States. Today, they go out before the public, they sort of stage a press conference. They don't have a press conference. The Europeans have a press conference. But they have a much publicized announcement of what the Federal Open Market Committee has done to change interest rates, to make monetary conditions more or less difficult. And the reason for that is that back in as late as 1970, when the Fed moved, big investment banks hired Fed watchers to figure out what, if anything, the Fed had done. Because the Fed operated through the money markets. What the banks responded to changes in the money markets. Bank lending greatly influenced the course of the economy, and the stock market reacted sometime later to changes in the economy. But nobody knew what the Fed was doing. It was a highly secretive institution. It was designed to be a secretive institution. Today, because it must work through the markets rather than through a limited number of banks, it must be a much more public institution, and it's having a lot of trouble coming to terms with that.
Well, the changes that have been made in that direction, is that something that was anyone's intention, Mr. Greenspan's or otherwise, or was it something that it would be more correct to say it was forced upon the Fed?
I think it's correct to say that it was forced upon it. Greenspan talks a good game of disclosure and is at least partially a convert. His basic statement is that in the old days, information was very expensive to gather, and therefore people were entitled to keep things secret. Today, information is much cheaper, and therefore the secrecy value is much less, and therefore we don't need all of these rules about bank secrecy, but we still have them. And as a matter of fact, one of the things the Fed has asked from the Congress in the last year is a tightening of the law which provides criminal penalties for anybody who reveals the contents of a bank examination. If you want to buy a bank, You have access to their books completely, but you may not get access to the most recent Examiner's report on the bank. That is secret even from people who are buying the institution until after they've bought it, which is pretty silly. But in the old days, a bank had a portfolio of loans. A bank examiner came along and said, you can indeed carry these loans at 100 cents on the dollar, or no, Jock, you're not going to get paid back in full on this. You have to write these things down to 70 or 50 or 40 or whatever it is cents on the dollar. And one of the ways that the government controlled the behavior of the banking system was that either they were tough on classifying loans or they were easy on classifying loans. And the world didn't know because the bank did not report these matters, didn't have to and didn't do it. And now, however, you know, in those days, banks were very closely held. A group of individuals, a couple of institutions, might hold all or virtually all the shares in a bank, and shares in a bank weren't traded much, very, very little. Now these guys are all listed corporations. They have to file the same 10-Ks that every other corporation has to file to inform stockholders and potential stockholders of what's happening. The market makes its own decisions about what the value of the assets in the bank's portfolio may be. Through the debt crisis of the 1980s, when Latin America was going bust, through, in fact, the Asian crisis of 1997-98, the banks continued to carry these loans at par on their books, and they never admitted until the end game that they were going to have to take any losses. But the market cut the prices of the bank stocks enormously because the market made its own judgment of the value of the bank's investments, and suddenly the Federal Reserve and the controller of the currency no longer have the full say over these matters because the market itself, on the basis of what information it can gather, will do its own valuation to the banks. That's just a different world.
Just for a moment, to return to the point you made just a moment ago about the bank examiners, this is something that's been noted in several of the reviews that I read of the book as being something of a stunning fact, the fact that not only do bank examiners not have the power that they once had to close banks, but that it's illegal for them to tell people what it is they found in examinations. Is that indeed something that's not commonly known? That's the conditions under which they operate. Is that a big surprise to a lot of people?
It may be. You know, one of my duties historically, as somebody who's written a lot of books, is to try to keep in mind what the world looked like to me before I learned what I now know. That's a very difficult intellectual exercise. As you get older, it gets to be more difficult. You ask me now, are people conscious of something? All I can say to you is that I make an effort to try to figure out what it is people know and don't know. It's a tough thing to find out, and after you've been writing about a subject, as I have for 25 years on this one, not to mention an academic background before that, I cannot look to myself at all and say, gee, what don't people know? I'm too thoroughly doused in the substance of the stuff. I do not think that people know the extent to which bank examiners are sworn to secrecy, or the extent to which, you know, part of the problem in all of this is that banks borrow money from you. When you put a deposit in a bank, what the bank is doing is borrowing money from you. The way a bank works, that money can be called and is called at any time you want it. You can write a check against it. So that you have an enormous confidence that when you write that check, that's good money. And if you get into a time of a banking panic, then suddenly people want to take cash out of the bank. You've seen it now, for example, in Argentina, where you have this crazy pegging of the peso to the dollar. It's not necessarily crazy at all times, but it is when you're part of a customs union, the other members of which have fluctuating currency. Anyway, what can happen is that there's a run on the bank. People want their money out now. We saw it in Ohio with an S&L crisis in the 1980s. We saw it in Rhode Island with a credit union crisis in the 1980s. Once people no longer believe they can write that check or they can go and they can get that cash, then they want to be the first out because there isn't going to be any last out. The last guys aren't going to get out. And one of the functions of the Federal Reserve, one of the functions of anybody who's establishing flexible currency, is to be the so-called, quote, lender of last resort. So that if the bank's assets are such that in healthier times they would more than cover its liabilities, more than cover the value of its deposits, then clearly some way has to be found to keep this institution going. On the other hand, you've got a situation like the one in Japan and the one in China and the one that we had in Sweden and the one that we had with the SNLs in this country in the 1980s, where in fact the assets are not worth anything like the liabilities, then you have a very intricate and difficult negotiating situation. The function of a central bank and the Fed and conditions of modern technology is unquestionably a central bank, even though the organization of the system is still that from a time when Congress did not want to have a central bank. Anyway, the Fed, as a central bank, has a responsibility to lend money to banks which are going to make it, and not to lend money to banks which are insolvent, and where if you give them more money, they will simply waste more money, which is what we have found. We found it in Korea in 98. We found it in China now. China has terrible problems coming up in that area. But that subtle distinction between the bank that should be saved because the assets are really okay, you just can't sell them now, and the bank that shouldn't be saved because it is a generator of dishonest and bad assets, that's a tough job, and that's the bank examiner's job. And every central bank has a tendency to give its banks the benefit of the doubt, because the central bank has to stand behind the currency. And if a bank that has issued a lot of checking accounts is not good for the money, that's part of the currency, and that's a disabling of the currency. Therefore, to finish this long exordium, the rest of the world has taken banking supervision away from the central banks and lodged it in an independent outside agency, the Financial Services Authority in England being the most prominent example. The Bank of England never did really examine banks. We'll just say about the Bank of England, it didn't care what you did so long as you didn't frighten the horses. But nevertheless, in theory, it was responsible for the health of the banking system. It no longer is. In Germany, the Bundesbank also is not an examiner of banks. In this country, in 1999, we went exactly the opposite way in the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which is perhaps the most remarkable of Alan Greenspan's accomplishments. After a 40-year war about who was going to be the leading regulator of the financial services industry, not just banks, the Fed came out of this bill with the so-called umbrella regulation, close quote. Its powers over the stock market and its powers over the insurance industry still have to be explored, and they exist only in terms of the fact that if a holding company also owns a bank, then its insurance operations and its securities operations are subject to scrutiny by the Federal Reserve. But where they will go with that, nobody knows. They have never thought it through. God knows Congress never thought it through. One of the great, there's a great moment in the conference report on this legislation, because the Securities and Exchange Commission will regulate the activities of a securities affiliate of a bank, but the Fed has umbrella regulation over everything that this institution does. So the question comes up, what if the Securities and Exchange Commission wants to promulgate a rule and the Fed doesn't like it? What can it do? And the answer given by the Congress in its wisdom is that the Fed can sue in the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and the judges of the Court of Appeals are enjoined by the Congress not to give preference to either the SEC's position or the Fed's position, and to treat the matter as, I quote, a jump ball, close quote. So that we still have a lot of confusion in this business.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with financial journalist Martin Mayer. He has more than 30 books to his credit. The most recent is titled The Fed, the inside story of how the world's most powerful financial institution drives the markets. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Free Press. Martin Mayer is a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal. He's popular columnist for OnMoney.com, and he's talking with us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, given the fact, as you have explained, that that now that banks aren't as important as lenders as they once were, and that had been primarily the way that the Fed could influence the market by determining what sort of money
the real economy.
The economy.
Franklin Roosevelt specifically warned his chairman of the Fed, Mariner Eccles, not to get involved with the market. And until quite recently, no chairman of the Fed would ever have admitted that he was involved with the market. And what's happened to the Fed is that it now must operate through the markets, must pay attention to markets in ways that it didn't before.
Yeah. The question I guess I was going for is exactly how it is that the Fed and Mr. Greenspan can do this, because it seems as if his power to influence the markets is indirect, to say the least.
Well, there's a maybe yes, maybe no. It depends on the situation. In October of 98, we had a worldwide financial crisis. My book begins with that. And it was possible for Greenspan to get out on center stage and cut interest rates just a little and say, we're going to help the world, as he did in 87, and things sort of righted themselves. In 1990-91, when the Fed huffed and puffed, and it took a long time to get the economy growing again, there was a problem of a real estate crisis. People had sunk a lot of money into buildings that were worth a lot less than they had paid for them. And there was and that loss was concentrated in the banking system because all real estate is financed by lending. Now we have a situation where there had been this silly NASDAQ bubble, enormous overvaluation of a lot of tech stocks, and the development of bad habits among the securities analysts and the reliance of investment banks and companies on initial public offerings, which essentially means selling the stuff to people who don't understand it. Back in the 70s, there was something called the greater fool theory, which is, doesn't matter how much I pay for a stock, there's a greater fool waiting to buy it from me for more. And we had this in spades early in the year 2000. The Fed was a contributor to that to some extent because it had produced a lot of liquidity at the turn of the year. They were afraid of the Y2K phenomenon, I think quite correctly, by the way, so that there was a lot of excess money floating around. It didn't go into consumer prices. It went into asset prices, and specifically it went into the tech sector, which is a great story, and which indeed, as Greenspan is reiterating today, is a real phenomenon. It's going to make a big difference in this country in the economy over time, has already made a difference, but has been egregiously overpriced. Anyway, so now we have a real phenomenon. We have a real phenomenon. Simply cutting the interest rates is not likely to do all that much good. It keeps the banks in better shape because, as I say, banks borrow all the money that they have. Their liabilities reprice the money they owe. The interest rate changes faster than it changes on the assets that they have. So when the Fed changes short-term interest rates, the banks get money cheaper, but their assets continue to earn them more, and therefore they get a cushion that protects them to some extent against their bad decisions. And also in the world of the normal consumer, he can borrow more easily against his house on a home equity loan. But in terms of what happens in the market, in theory, corporate equity is worth a number which is the discounted value of a stream of future earnings. You discount those future earnings which you assume or your broker tells you are going to happen by an interest rate that has a relationship to the short-term rate that the Fed sets. So there is a tendency, whenever the Fed raises interest rates, for assets to be worth a little less, and whenever the Fed lowers interest rates, for assets to be worth a little more, because the asset has a yield, and the yield on that asset generates a higher value for the principal piece. And this has been true for a long time. This has been understood certainly since the early 19th century. It doesn't always work, as you could see today. Though today the market was coming back. Last I looked, and there was fairly early knowledge of what it was Greenspan was saying, and the market was still quite substantially down. There's a limit to how often you can take the bucket to the well. The markets at some point in the game are going to want to see the real results. They're going to want to see real earnings coming out of the fact that people's costs have been reduced by reductions in the interest rate. And as Greenspan points out, and good summary today. The lowered interest rate was more than matched by the higher energy prices and also by the fact that long-term interest rates didn't move. He said nobody knows whether the long-term interest rates didn't move because people feel that there's a danger of inflation or because people feel the good times are coming back. It's a very interesting statement. But the fact is that the Fed has cut 2 and 3/4 percentage points off the interest rates that the banks have to pay to get money. And out in the long-term 30-year market, the rates have barely changed. Mortgage rates are roughly the same today as they were a year ago.
We have, pardon me for jumping in. I was going to say that we have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? We'll start out with someone in Charleston, and that will be line number four. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
I have a, I don't mean to change the topic quite, but
please do.
At the beginning of the conversation, of the talk, he mentioned that, Greenspan still are answering dumb questions by members of Congress. I wonder if you'd comment just a little bit on that, not a great deal. My impression was that most members of the committee have been on that committee for their full careers and pretty skilled and pretty knowledgeable about the matter. So while I've noticed that occasionally members of Congress will begin their period with a short Grahamstanding in honor of Phil Graham to their constituents, they have some pretty sharp questions. I wonder if he would comment on that just a little bit, please.
Well, the Senate's better than the House. The House Banking Committee is 50-some members, and every one of them has a right to question the chairman of the Fed when he makes his annual Humphrey Hawkins presentation. Even in the Senate, you get people who have their King Charles's head and things they have to talk about all the time. And well, I would agree that the level of understanding in the Senate on the average is higher than it is in the House. Just as a mathematical matter, there are so many too many members of the House Banking Committee. I mean, the House Banking Committee gets filled up because these are guys who make political because banks make political contributions. Banks, insurance companies, securities firms, all of these guys are big contributors to politicians, and therefore everybody wants to be on the committee, which gives them an in to get money out of people they supposedly regulate. The Senate is a little better, though here, too, the level of understanding varies. This is fairly technical stuff, and in a funny way, it comes through the Congress only for the expression of opinion. The Fed is unique among government agencies in that it doesn't have an appropriation. It prints the money. It prints the money it spends. And after spending and printing the money, it turns over the rest of the profits to the Treasury. And the General Accounting Office over the Fed's dead body does have the right to come and audit the books. But congressmen usually have to look at issues not only as a matter of policy, but also as a matter of spending money on something or not spending money on something. And this is an area where that whole element doesn't exist. And therefore, you tend to get rather theoretical pronouncements. People tend to be more influenced by what they may have heard on television or read in the newspapers, possibly planted there by their staff, than they are by their own knowledge of these things. But I would agree that the Senate tends to ask better questions than the House. Nevertheless, I have sat behind Greenspan, both in the Senate and the House, while he's answering questions. And one of the things I admire him for most is his ability to take a dumb question and make it something that is worthy of an intelligent answer.
Good. Thanks for your answer.
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go here to someone else. It's Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering basically how much the Fed, when it is looking at its concern for inflation, how much of that of concern for inflation is actually the concern for workers' wages increasing?
They look at all the information imaginable. They have a very large staff of research economists who are paid better than people are paid elsewhere in the government. Many of them have joint appointments with business schools, which enables them to do even better. And Greenspan himself is, as a fellow governor once said, he's the only man who disaggregates data. You bring him an index. He wants to know how much of this is oil prices, how much of it is natural gas, how much of it is hydroelectric power, how much of it is long-term, how much of it is short-term. You bring him an index on wages. He wants to know about the industries involved, about the skill level. He's absolutely omnivorous devourer of facts and information. And one of the things you can claim for the Fed, I have my doubts about some of the things you claim for the Fed, but one that's fair enough, is that there are 12 district banks, and the presidents of the 12 district banks come to the meetings of the Federal Open Market Committee where they discuss interest rate changes, and they bring with them the information from their districts of the country. Each of them has his own board. The board consists to a significant degree of people who are businessmen active in this community. They have branches in various communities. The Fed is the repository of about as much information as you can have. In fact, the danger is a little the other way, which is that because your information inevitably is backward-looking, you may have a tendency simply to extrapolate forward something that's been going on when really you should sit down and think and say, wait a minute, does this make sense?
So I'm correct if you're saying that workers' wages is a...
That what?
Workers' wages.
Well, they have the same wage. I mean, their wage data comes from the Department of Labor, but they also have a lot of information from businesses in the districts about what changes there are in wage rates.
Right, because what percentage of data would or concern would wages be for their determination of when do lower interest rates?
How much weight do they give to wage rates? Well, there was a theory, and it was I never thought much of it myself, but it was predominant among economists of the non-accelerating rate of unemployment, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, NARU. And there was a theory that once you get to a certain level of unemployment, once unemployment falls, we used to say below 6%, 7% even, then you would get wage pressure, which would create inflation. I never believed it myself, but there's no question that the Fed believed it. It was Milton Friedman's baby too, and virtually every professor of economics believes it seems to make some sense. Wage rates go up, that pushes up prices. I never thought that because my observation always was that wages go up in response to price and increases. You have a terrible problem with wages after you've had some inflation. You can't stop the inflation because everybody is playing catch-up. But I never thought that's what started it. What started it was shocks like the oil price rises. Nevertheless, there was a belief at the Fed. And one of the things you have to credit Greenspan for is that he was willing to say, from his study of the immediate past, this doesn't seem to be happening. Let's not be a slave to this theory. Let's let things go. He did let things go. We had much more prosperity in the 90s than we would have had otherwise, and a high fraction of it was real. Some of it was not real, and the part of it that was not real is what's punishing us now.
Yeah.
But the wages question, the Fed pays close attention to this, close attention to profits, pays close attention to all the data that you can get,
right.
But has not permitted itself in the last 5 years to be dominated by the question that if there's too little unemployment, then we're going to get inflation. Greenspan killed that.
Yeah, well, this was curious to me because I seem to notice that just as real wages started to climb, and that's when Greenspan started raising interest rates to stimulate.
Nah, he's basically said that Nehru doesn't exist. I think that he worries about the climbing in wages to the extent that his productivity measures don't validate it. I'm not a big fan of productivity measures. Productivity is a residual. You take one not very good number, which is the gross domestic product, you divide it by another not very good number, which is the labor force, and you then come up with something which I don't doubt that there's been an increase in productivity. I just think it's very difficult to measure. Greenspan began raising interest rates he did it to some extent in 1999. The whole move from bottom to top on that was only 175 basis points. We've done much more than that since, and there was no evidence at that time that there was an increase in real wages. That came really later in 99 and in 2000 when he's been lowering rates.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I find myself, Mr. Mayor, going back to this notion or this question of we often say that Alan Greenspan is one of the most powerful, sometimes people might say he was the most powerful individual in this country, and wondering whether indeed he has the kind of power to influence the economy that is attributed to him.
No. He doesn't, and he knows it, and he's said it at various times. On your most powerful, the week that we left Washington, which we have done, by the way, there was a story in the Washington Post. There was a big party for Bob Schieffer of CBS, and the story in the Post said the most powerful man in the world came, and so did the president. and there is a lot of this. And, you know, people ask me what I think is the worst, and I say that so far as I'm concerned, the worst is this notion that Alan Greenspan can kiss it and make it well. He can't, nor could he have created a boom. The role of monetary policy is a significant role, but it is not a governing role. I don't know whether you saw my piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, where I quote from Larry Myers, who's one of the governors, that the Fed models assume that changes in interest rates are policy reactions. Changes in the Fed funds rate, not a driving force. And that's right. It's what they have been trying to do is there's a real downturn in what had been the liveliest part of the economy. The most recent estimate is that only 5% of the fiber optic cable that's been laid down has been used. I remember just
Forgive me, Mr. Mayor, but you're sort of fading on us there.
I'm sorry.
yeah,
we are all lemmings. A couple of years ago, I was telling people, you know, this telecom boom and this IT boom. That stuff is for real. It isn't just a bunch of nerds in Silicon Valley, and people on the Dulles Corridor, and people in Silicon Gulch in New York. Three times this year, they've dug up the pavement in front of my house in Washington to lay fiber optic cable. That's lots of jobs for grunts. It's lots of jobs for real people. And then there are even more jobs because they do such a lousy job of repaving that there are lots of potholes, which gives work to auto mechanics and to people to repair the potholes. But this is, and it never occurred to me that there wasn't going to be demand for three competing fiber optic services on 42nd Street Northwest in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
We all get caught up in these perceptions that if other people are doing something, they must know what they're doing. And this happens to the Federal Reserve, too. Happens particularly to Greenspan, whose brand of conservatism is one which says that the guys who run the country are the guys who should be running the country. And the people ahead of the big corporations really should be heads of the big corporations. I mean, that it's a Leibniz view of the world. All is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. So that there is always a tendency to believe that if something is going on, the guys doing it must know why they're doing it. This is not always true. And sometimes it goes on long enough untruthfully that you get yourself into considerable trouble. Greenspan, in today's testimony, as a matter of fact, said that there used to be a belief that you could tame the business cycle. He credits Keynes with arguing that. Keynes really, I don't think, ever quite thought that. But and you can't do it because you can't change human nature. And there's a good deal of truth to that, but you can mitigate. And one of the things that the Fed has done in the first 6 months of 2001 is prevented a very sharp decline in the earnings of a lot of companies, of most companies, from producing anything like that sharp a decline in the stock market. Yes, the NASDAQ market tanked, but those guys didn't have any earnings anyway. That was all a story. But in terms of the Dow is maybe 10% or a little less below its peak, even though earnings in the Dow companies are down too. That's been done essentially by lowering the interest rates, which changes the value of a discounted stream of future earnings and has prevented things getting worse. Now, if earnings keep going down, and that's what's bothering the market right now, which is they very well may keep going down for some small period and some even medium period, the market eventually is not going to respond to the Fed's blandishments. And the question then comes, how closely connected is the real economy with the market? In 1987, the market dropped 21% in one day, and virtually nothing happened. So we don't know. But nevertheless, there's no doubt that the attitudes in the country would be a lot worse if the market were down 2,000 points from where it is now, which is what I think most people I know would consider a reasonable valuation. But those are only that's a limited collection. There was the Council on Foreign Relations had a simulation of a crash and what could people do about a crash a couple of years ago, and I was one of the people invited to be part of the group, about 40 of us, and I was on the central banking group, and the first message that came down from headquarters was the markets have crashed. The Dow was at 8,000, and we sent back a message saying, that seems reasonable. We're not going to intervene much on that. So they then cut it down to 7, and at this point we began acting. But there is always a tendency, particularly for poor devils who buy in toward the end of a bull market, to think that that's what's natural. The market is still selling for 20, 21, 22, 23 times anticipated earnings. And that's a fairly high multiple. So that, in fact, the psychology of the market has not been that negative. All of these nature fakers on Wall Street have been able to keep people pumped up a little more than they should be. But Greenspan is also right that if the market prices don't drop too much, it helps people continue to plan more expenditure than they would have planned otherwise.
We have just about 5 minutes left, and we have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get in a few more. Let's go to Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hello, sir.
Yes.
My name is Lucy Perry, and I want to know if these national banks, are they private corporations or do they belong to the federal government?
You mean the Federal Reserve banks?
Yes.
Federal Reserve banks are indeed owned by stockholders. The stockholders are the banks of the district.
So they are private.
And the limits on what they can do was set by the Board of Governors in Washington, which is a government agency and government-owned. But the 12 district banks.
All right. I understand national banks pay no taxes on their
No. These are Federal Reserve banks. There's a difference. National banks are just ordinary banks which are nationally chartered. Federal Reserve banks pay no taxes, but they give all of their profits. They do pay local taxes.
Well, no, that's not income tax. That's local taxes.
That's right. No, they they give virtually all the money, not quite all. Actually, Congress just took their mad money fund away from them. But the Federal Reserve every year gives 96-97% of all the money it makes to the federal government. It's the largest single item on receipts, probably. It's $20-odd billion.
Okay, I have one more statement I want to make, and I'm going to hang out. Inflation is caused by the interest you are forced to pay on the money you are forced to borrow. Government, corporation, the individual all have to borrow money, but when the banks loan them the money, they loan them the money to pay back the principal, but they don't loan them the money to pay back the interest.
That's right. If you lend money, if you capitalize interest, you get compound interest working against you. The loans get bigger and bigger and bigger while people don't get any more money out of them.
Well, they have to earn more money to pay the interest. How are they going to get ahead?
Well, what
get out of debt.
What happened with the SNLs is that they kept capitalizing the interest until people finally owed a lot more than the property was worth. It's important not to owe more than the collateral is worth. If you owe more than the collateral is worth, then essentially you own the bank, and that's not good for other people who might want to borrow from the bank.
I'm going to try to squeeze one more here. Let's go to Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. You were kind of more gentle on Greenspan, and in one of your previous books, you included the document that gave the clean bill of health to the.
Oh, yeah, to Keating. I mention that in this book.
Oh, you do?
I mention that in this book, and I also print some paragraphs from his idiotic piece for Ayn Rand on gold.
Uh-huh. And the fact that he actually was in charge of a mutual fund that went down, which is...
That's right. His own market sense is very questionable, and, of course, Greenspan himself owns no stocks. He's felt that he shouldn't, and I think he's probably right, though, of course, Federal Reserve decisions affect the value of the short-term government paper that...
He's less deified now, I think, but...
Yes. No, that thing, Greenspan has been much oversold. And I am ambivalent about aspects of Greenspan's personality and actions, but I think he's been a good chairman of the Fed. I would not necessarily have done all the things that he's done, but at the same time, that there may be very good reasons why he's chairman and I'm not.
I wanted to ask you about something you pointed out earlier about just the way the banking industry isn't being regulated as much. You were saying that it's because the Federal Reserve is doing that. I'd like for you to expand.
Well, I think the Fed is not a good supervisor of banks, and I think that on for reasons of principle and for reasons of practicality, the Federal Reserve should not be supervising and examining banks. The rest of the world has decided a central bank does not need this function. I think we should re-examine it, but this is a real war, this one. But I think that when you get into a time of crisis, there is a tendency for a central bank to choose inflationary solutions because they get scared and because they are responsible for money only. Other people who have greater responsibility for the probity and operation of financial institutions. The Fed is a sucker for a lot of people who probably ought not to be running banks. And this goes way back. The Fed has never been a happy participant in efforts to control money laundering. The Fed is, I think, a problem on the supervisory front, and I think long-term capital management demonstrated it in a very interesting way. But we're a long way from that. Greenspan fought that fight and won it against the fact that everybody else in the world was going the other way.
We're going to have to stop because we've used our time. We'll have to leave it there. Mr. Mayer, thanks very much
for talking with us.
Our guest, Martin Mayer, and if you're interested in reading his book, once again, the title is The Fed, The Inside Story of How the World's Most Powerful Institution Drives the Markets, published by the Free Press.